the Russian Navy. Besides, it is in the national interest of the Empire of all the Russia that the Navy manning Alaska. And they were clever infighters, these Americans. And they did have a prop. Russia ain't got any decent ports for naval base. They've only got one. Really, that's Archangel. Maybe Murmansk. None of the rest of them are worth anything. The Navy can't get to sea. I didn't have Vladivostok at this time, but even if you got Vladivostok, look at the problem. Look who's got you surrounded, the Japanese. They can't get out here. That's a mess. Can't get out here. That's a problem. And the Russian Navy knew they were going to go to war with the British sooner or later. They knew it for a very good reason. The Russian Navy was founded by British admirals throughout the entire 18th century. It was run by British admirals, and they all knew that. They didn't like them. They knew they were going to wind up going to war. We got to get a deep water Navy. What better way to do it than sail to Alaska? Isn't that great? St. Petersburg to Alaska. What a line of communication. And, of course, if we're sitting up there in the North Pacific, we can pull some interesting stunts, I suppose. That was on their mind. Baranoff learned something from the whalers. Something I'm sure you're all aware of. Surprising how many people are aware of it. One of the most important strategic locations in the whole world is Sitka, Alaska. Right here. And the whalers were the one that found this. Because it was a very convenient place to get in. And if I had a nice big globe of the world, you could see how from Sitka you could dominate the whole North Pacific. It's a beautiful place. And for the ships of that time, it was a good port. And of course, we used it in World War II. And that's why he went there. Baranoff didn't go there by accident. It would have been a good place to put the Russian Navy if they were going to fight the British in the North Pacific. Also, they had a bunch of other smart ideas. This would give them a lot of experience sailing the ocean blue, which they really needed, that experience. And also, they could get money from the Russian-American company to subsidize the Navy. And Russia didn't have much money then, just like it doesn't have today. It's like any other government, kind of short on money. And the naval officers had a third problem. They were running scared. In 1817, the Russian government got a brilliant idea. We're going to make all our soldiers into farmers. And they will till the soil in military communes, and they will be completely self-supporting, and they will also be soldiers, and we can have a great big army, and it won't cost us 1 cent. Now, the only other nut in history to pull this stunt was Mao Zedong. It's the way he built the People's Liberation Army. Nicholas I thought this was a great idea, and the Navy could see that coming. They could see the handwriting on a wall. Unless they had a meal ticket going for them, there wasn't going to be a Russian Navy. So they picked on Russian America, and they ran it. Then they did kind of a halfway decent job, as a matter of fact, depending on your point of view. The first thing they did, of course, was almost cause a war. Because they got the bright idea to control the whole North Pacific and exclude the British and the Americans, and that really didn't work out so very well. So in 1825, they settled the differences, and that's where we got our borders. You all realize the strangest border we got right here, 141st parallel, meridian, right down here. Well, that was made up by the British and the Russians. Now, this border down here was kind of uncertain at the time. It was adequate for the period. They did define it, and when we bought Russia, we bought Alaska, we bought it under the borders already agreed to by the British and the Russians in 1825. They cut off the grand idea of conquering and controlling the whole North Pacific rather quickly. As a matter of fact, even the Tsar thought this was a dum-dum. He found out about it from the British, apparently, and he said, that's a no-no. If you take the period, say, from 1820 to 1840, I did rather well. I brought in schools, libraries, churches. They also brought in an administrative overburden that they really couldn't support. Something like approximately 1/4 of the 1.5 million rubles out of a total net income of 8 million rubles, you can figure that out, went to administrative overhead. Another, if I remember the number right, about 1.8 million went to taxes. This was on the tea that they brought back from Kiaka. They were tea peddlers. Like a modern aerospace company. That's what they became. When you let the military run something, you know, that's what's going to happen. They didn't have any Baranovs. They had people who ran on 5-year tours of duty, and you know that's the way the military likes to do it. And they got some sharp characters. Really? Wrangel was one. Edelin was another. Gentlemen. Scholars. Explorers. Writers. Genteel naval officers. With a secure income, who served their duty and left. They didn't have that sense of dedication that Baranov and Rezanov, Shelikov, and a few others had. In the 1840s, there were some marked changes. They sold Fort Ross because it was more expensive than it was worth. They made a deal with the Hudson's Bay Company. They leased most of southeastern Alaska to Hudson's Bay for trading. It was better than fighting them over it. And in exchange, they got their foodstuffs from Vancouver. So the main supplier of foods now became Canada and the Hudson's Bay Company. The Hudson's Bay Company came over the Porcupine River, established a post here at Fort Yukon. The Russians really didn't do anything about that. They embarked on an interesting program. The Russian-American Company was really restricted to this coastal littoral, this marine west coast climate. They began moving into the interior, the Yukon, the Susitna, the Copper, the Kuskokwim, establishing bases, sending out explorer parties, and you get one of these peculiarities. We translate things as redoubts. And there were, in the Russian, the word is Adinochka, which means a place with one guy in it. And on our maps, it came out fort. That's an awful fort with one guy sitting in a log cabin up there. They also put an establishment up in here. It wasn't a short life. And we're trying to get into the interior fur trade. One of the systems that had developed in Alaska under the Russian period was the interior people were trapping fur, and the people kind of right along the coast were the middlemen in this fur trade traffic, selling it to the Russians. And the Russians wanted to get through the middlemen. The Zagoskin, reputed a great explorer, and he was, and a great ethnographer, and he was also a guy who recommended, let's cut out the middlemen. Now, as a result of this attempt to cut out the middlemen, quite a few Russians got killed. And this was one of the origins of the belief by some Americans that natives in Alaska were pretty wild people. They got involved in selling things to San Francisco. They sold ice. Isn't that great? Can you think of exporting ice from here to San Francisco? But they did. And we ain't got no shortage of that. It was sort of a trading empire. There was a great smallpox plague, which they got blamed for. It came from the Mandan Indians. One of the results of the Lewis and Clark expedition was to open the Mandan Indians to white traders, and one of the first things the white traders brought up to the Mandan Indians was smallpox, which moved across the Northwest, up through Oregon, British Columbia, and into Alaska. The Russians got blamed for it. They were sensitive about it. They carried out the first successful vaccination program against smallpox west of the Mississippi River. Very successful program. And when smallpox reappeared in the early 1860s, that didn't hurt nobody. They built a church. You can blame a fella called Veniaminov. He was 27 when he came here, a little bit out of my category. But he lived to be so old it was terrible. He wound up being the head of the Russian Orthodox Church, the one that built the cathedral in Sitka. The most successful missionary operation in the history of the Russian state. And it's still around in places. They also had a problem. And it was a new one. And one they couldn't handle. And it was an awful problem. Well, we've got the Wrangels and the Ethelins and the other very dignified, scientific, type, brilliant naval officers serving their time in Alaska before they go back to their family estates and their books and their writings in St. Petersburg, where they go chasing off Zenobia's in the eye. We got another Baranov type character over here. And this guy's name is Muravyov. Sounds like a mouthful, doesn't it? That's a beautiful name, actually, if you pronounce it right. And he decides, you know, the problem of Russia is that we need the Amur Basin. And these Chinese are just a bunch of paper tigers. And he proves it, and off he goes, down the Amur. Nerd! He gets a bunch of boats, he puts some colonists on it, a few guns, he comes to a Chinese port, and the Chinese say, stop or I'll shoot. And he says, what'd you say, as he floats by? I didn't take the whole thing. Kind of stopped here. This is the town of Khabarovsk. That's the military center for the Soviet Far East. And he went north on the Amur. And from there, he opened three lines of communication to Petropavlovsk. Meanwhile, the Tsar Nicholas II, who was probably one of the greatest losers of all time, manages to pull a real dum-dum. He gets himself simultaneously into a war with Russia, France, Turkey, and Piedmont, Sardinia. You've all heard the charge of the Light Brigade, the reason why these guys got themselves shellacked. What you don't hear about is the fact that the Russians lost the war. It's the truth. The British did not know how to use cavalry in the Crimean War. But then the British have never known how to use cavalry in their entire history anyway, so it really shouldn't be surprising. What they did know how to use was infantry. And this great Russian Navy that supposedly has been subsidized and it's a deep water fleet can only think of one thing to do. It scuttles itself across the mouth of Sevastopol, and that's the end of it. And the British do their thing. They sail around the Black Sea and they lob shells. Any place the water's deep, they pull a lanyard and lob some shells. They got a surprise when they came up here. They came off Helsinki. The Russians had a great big port off Helsinki. And they're sitting there firing the shells. A rowboat, a bunch of Finns come out and they climb on board the ship. Now, you all remember this character in Baltimore who wrote our national anthem, you know, and he gets on board the ship and he watches the rockets sail around and while he's making a deal for some prisoners to escape. He's treating with the enemy. But the Finns climb on board the ship and they say, boy, this is a nice ship, and they took it over, sailed it into Helsinki. Now, that was the only real loss they had. Well, out in the Pacific, they had a brilliant idea. We're going to go up here and lob some shells at Petropavlovsk. I can't think of any reason at all why the Royal Navy would want to go up and take Petropavlovsk. Most of them couldn't even pronounce it, I'm sure, but you have to do something, don't you? I mean, the boys back home, there's a war going on. And they get up there and they're sitting off the bay and pulling the lanyard, and all of a sudden they're getting a lot of static from the shore, like there's a few cannon up there. But this character, in secret, hauled a bunch of cannons
down this river, sailed it across the sea, and placed it
the day before the breeze rock, and the state get us across.
Now, there was another problem that this war brought her up. Not only was the Russian Navy no good. Don't say that today. I think it's a pretty good Navy. But if it is, it's the first time they've had a good one, actually, in their entire history. They almost lost Alaska. At least they thought they did. Actually, the Russian-American Company, the Hudson Bay Company, decided, you know, if we're going to do our fight, let's do it down in the Crimea. That's a nice place. Lots of malaria down there. The water's bad. Lots of soldiers will get killed. We ain't going to do any fighting up here. Although they could have taken it like that. And the Russians. Now, there is one distinguished scholar, and he's an historian, so he may know what he's talking about, who says one of the reasons the British went along with this deal was because they thought if they didn't, the Russians would sell Alaska to the United States. Now, of course, there's that historic precedent for this, you know, the character Napoleon, he conquered Spain. And he sent some people over and he took over all the Spanish territories in the United States, to which he had no legal title at all. And the British said, you know, we're going to fix you for that. And he said, I'll take care of it. And he sold it to us, right? Louisiana Purchase. We don't have any valid claim at all. Stolen property. But anyway, since we'd done that sort of thing in the past, and there were people talking about doing it in the late 1850s, particularly people from San Francisco making all this money buying frozen water from Alaska. If we could get a deal going on that one, I guess. Probably could to L.A. They made a deal. Now, Muravyov left the Amur in 1860. Well, he didn't disappear off the scope. He goes back and works in the Admiralty in St. Petersburg, and he's saying all along, get rid of that place. The place to put your money, buddy, is right here. By this time, he owns property in the area anyway. Now, who's the head of the Navy? Grand Duke Constantine, who was, I guess, fairly intelligent. Probably had an IQ somewhere around 65, which is probably pretty good if you're going to be a Grand Duke. And he's got a bunch of staff officers saying, get rid of that place. It's a line item in the budget now. Remember, that's a terrible thing, a line item in the budget, right? We got to put our money down here. Now, everybody will tell you the reason they sold Alaska was because they were losing money on it. And they would have to subsidize it. How much money do you think they lost over here? They ain't never made no money out. They've had two wars over that one. Spanning into that area, they wound up fighting the Japanese. And the great Russian fleet went out, and the Japanese said, looked at that, and they said, that's a pretty fleet. And they sent the whole cotton picking thing right to the bottom. And that's how to lose money. Real motivation. We got these people in the Admiralty, in the Navy, and they're saying, let's get shed of this thing because our interest is Vladivostok, the Amur Basin, that's right. You got other people saying, we can't defend that place, and the British will take it away from us, and what we ought to do is get rid of it before it becomes a real bad liability. Now, the Russians at that time were not very frightened. There's one thing they knew. That's how to take land away from somebody else. Very good at that. And they were doing it in Spain. Now, as a result of the Crimean War, the British and the French said, no more Russian warships on the Black Sea. They don't like that. What the Russians wanted to do was take the mouth of the Danube. You notice they almost got it now. They sit right there on the left bank of the Danube, but any time these people here in Romania get too excited about anything, the Russians just cut them off from the sea and they'll take care of it. Ismail, that fort the Russians have taken so many times in their history is just almost pathetic. They also want to move down in here. That means war with Turkey, war with France, war with Britain down in here. They got Poland and these cotton-picking poles. You know, you can't trust a Polak. They have a revolt. You've all heard this little tune, La Polonaise. Everybody listen to it. Everybody listen. and they looked great. Now, somewhere in about 1820, the British aristocracy decided to hate Russians. Now, it comes about 1820. Could have been a few years earlier or a few years later, but all of a sudden, all the travelers going to Russia hate Russians. And they all decide they're going to dislike the Russians. The Russians knew that. And it's a beautiful, distinguished history. And you tell a guy enough times, you tell him for 30 years you hate him, sooner or later, you know what? He's going to believe it. The Russians believe it.
They knew that the only way they were going to get what they wanted in this part of the world was probably by fighting Russia, fighting England. The other thing they were doing was taking this part of the world, now called Soviet Central Asia. And you know, the city butts on it, Afghanistan, and the Russians are deep in Afghanistan, and over you go, Afghanistan, Pakistan, down into northern India. And you think it's silly, but Alexander the Great did it, the Mongols did it, and if you've read any Kipling, the British thought the Russians could do it, and Paul I tried it after all. And I often wondered if those 90,000 crazy Cossacks just might have conquered all of England. You never can tell with those guys.
1863, the Polish revolt, and it looks like war with England, and the Navy now has got a problem.
What are we going to do? Sink all our ships in harbor again, fellas? That ain't good. Now, they're imitators. They ain't too smart, but they're imitators. And there's these characters down in the South, United States. They didn't have any navy either. Now, they went to England and they bought some ships and they put some iron chains in the side and they hired a crew and they put some fancy officers on. They went all over the place sinking Yankee ships. And they sank them in the Bering Straits and they sank them all over the Atlantic and they just sank them in space. And the Russian Navy looked at that and said, you know, that'd be a good idea. That we could do. We could run around and sink British ships. Long as they ain't got cannon on them, we can sink them. But where are you going to do it from? Well, you got to have a good port. One in Atlantic, one in Pacific. What are the two best ports? One in Atlantic and the Pacific. San Francisco and New York. So they went to San Francisco and New York. And we thought this was just great. Now, there are a lot of distinguished historians who say it was not an act of friendship to the United States of America that the Russian Navy came, and maybe it wasn't, but we thought it was. We were real grateful that anybody said howdy do in those days. After all, we were about to go to war with England at that time, and if our ambassador to England had had his choice, we would have gone to war. If it hadn't been for old Albert, we still might have got the war. You've all seen the movie. He stayed up all night, almost on his deathbed to redraft the note. The Russians had been a big help to us. In 1780, armed neutrality. They attempted to mediate the American Revolution. They did, I think, mediate part of the results of the War of 1812. Now, we liked them. And they sent their navy, and nobody else did that. All the French did was send this nut down to Mexico City that causes all the trouble. That's all they did. The British were helping our enemies. The Russians sent a navy, and it was great. And we liked it. They were afraid of what would happen if this Polish revolt got out of hand, or if what would happen when they got the war with England, which they really expected they were going to have. We felt they were pretty friendly. We liked them, and we had real interest in the area anyway. We knew there was gold up there. We knew there was coal. We knew there was fish. We knew there was a lot of property sitting around there you could buy from the Russian-American Company the minute they decided to sell out. Our whalers were all over the place, and we wanted to build a telegraph line, and we'd been fooling around up in the Yukon. Stringing this line up here, we knew a lot about Alaska at the time, and it really was a good deal. And then you can add another little argument to the whole story, which is kind of the ending argument, which I think is absolutely fascinating. And that, of course, is the fact that the guy who bought it was a president who was almost impeached by one vote. Now, we all think of Sumner and Seward, but the guy who signed off on it was Andrew Johnson, right? Johnson's a bad name to have if you want to be president. And there's one thing that nobody ever reads. Nobody ever pays any attention to. See, I'm a history buff, so I can afford to read this crazy stuff. Why did Johnson say we should buy it? Everybody knows what Sumner said. It goes on forever. It's a beautiful historic document written by a bunch of guys in the Smithsonian Institute, one of whom famous was Bannister, who could read Russian. I'm sympathetic to him, but he got a credit line, so you can't complain. Beautiful job. Sumner knew what he was talking about. Seward knew what he was talking about. Nobody ever admits that Johnson knew what he was talking about. He was only the president, commander-in-chief, the guy who signed off on it. He came up with quite an interesting argument that nobody else made. And it went like this. You know, we just had a war with the Southerners. And they had all these ships. And they had them out in the Atlantic. And they even had the last one was up in the Bering Straits, you know. So we'd already surrendered. And this guy's up there sinking whaling ships like it was just more fun than a barrel of monkeys. So why couldn't we get these guys? And why couldn't we stop these fellas from importing all that good cannons and guns from the Bahamas? Because we didn't have any overseas bases. The Navy's got to have bases. As a matter of fact, there are three bases we really need that are vital to our national defense. One is Iceland, for control of the North Atlantic. We got that in 1941. Another is Greenland. We picked up three solid bases in Greenland in 1942. And the third is Alaska. Johnson recognized, as did nobody else officially at that time, the military strategic importance of this little piece of real estate. And that's the reason he gave for buying. Finish up with a few words. In 1786, there were supposed to have been 150 Russians in Alaska. In 1860, there were 784. And they left behind them a substantial native population of mixed parentage, many literate. They left behind many, many towns, Sitka, St. Michael, Wrangell, Lewisville, Yakutat. They mined 2,500 tons of coal down in the Kenai. They built ships, built steam power ships. They explored coastal Alaska. They left very good maps behind them. They gave us a whole set of archives, beautiful natural histories. And they did it all with about 700 people. And I say to you, that's quite an achievement. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Don, for really quite an expansive and extensive talk. You took us over most of the world there. Very good. Who was it that someone had an announcement that they wanted? Did you have an announcement?
I know that you said we only do business.
We've been quite concerned over the Wickersham House, and it's been sitting here for a couple of years now with nothing being done. And so Mr. Lardy had asked me to get on the subject and see what we could do about it. So I've called the various people involved, and believe me, there seem to be a lot. And the gist of it is that Mr. Butrovich says that if John Butrovich says that if we can get our data together and present it to our legislature, that he thinks we can get state funding to get the Wickersham House going. Now, and he's using the precedent of the Erskine House in Kodiak that was once our Russian own building there. And Don Stetson here came on the site of Alaska Land and reported to Lee Russell that it would cost about $19,000 to do this. And it's possible that we will be able to get national funding after we get it, after we get a budget for this and have it moved. They want to move it from its present site where it's sitting over where the little bandstand is, since the bandstand seems to have no purpose at this time. So it looks like we're going to be able to get not only state but federal funding also, so we will get but now they want to cut down the amount of price that it would cost, of course, and so if we can get our people interested in this, maybe we can get a contractor who would help us move it or help do some of the work and so on, and be able to get it so the state will pass this. We don't want to drop this one, as we had to drop the Miller House incident through no fault of our own. We would like to really get this Wickersham House going if we could. So they feel that we need to get our funding right down on paper so that we can present it to the state legislature, and then once we get it, the money appropriated, then we can get a fund set aside by the national government, which will pay for having somebody in there to take care of it all the time.
Well, I think the ladies have some refreshments. How soon will they be ready, or are they ready now? All right, then I think we'll adjourn. I'm sure Dr. Lynch, if you want to go up and say hello and ask him some particular questions, he'll be glad to talk with you. And thank you all for coming.